Leadership shouldn't be about who speaks the loudest, but rather who speaks the truest. I'm Charlotte Otto. Welcome to Speech Bubbles, the podcast that's rewriting the rulebook on leadership, communication, and success. In every episode, we're bursting the bubbles of traditional leadership, bringing you raw, real conversations with trailblazers who don't just challenge the status quo, they obliterate it. We're talking to heads of communication who know the power of words, HR mavericks reshaping workplace culture, and leaders from backgrounds that have been silenced for far too long. This is where vulnerability meets strategy, where authenticity beats artifice, where diverse voices don't just speak, they roar. Whether you're climbing the corporate ladder or building your own, Speech Bubbles is your roadmap to leadership that's human, powerful, and unapologetically you. Are you ready to transform how you communicate, lead, and succeed? Then let's burst some bubbles. My guest today is Aparna Bhasin. Aparna Bhasin is a founder, facilitator, and coach. Her business, Aparna Bhasin Consulting, recently hit a 10-year milestone. While her consulting initially focused on education and healthy child and adolescent development, it has broadened in scope over the years. The business has worked with over 40 partners, ranging from multinational corporates to small low-income educational institutions, from multi-sector foundations to smaller not-for-profits and social enterprises across the social sector landscape. While the firm is based out of Mumbai, India, their projects have spanned multiple geographies. Having studied at Columbia, HEC Paris, and Oxford Said Business School, and done research with UNICEF, Aparna always works in direct practice, building solutions with her partners. She also provides one-to-one coaching. Aparna says, "In how we work, we aim to build a deep understanding of context, rely on and contribute to the existing evidence base, strive towards sustainability, and always prioritize impact." Aparna Bhasin, welcome to Speech Bubbles. It's lovely to have you with us today. So Aparna, most of your work is with community-based organizations or organizations that aim to serve communities. And you mentioned recently that there's a shift coming for Aparna Bhasin Consulting. What's changing and what's staying the same?
Absolutely. And I love to talk about this. So I'm excited for that question. There's a few things that I'm looking to shift. And I think, you know, I was quite young when I started working, so there's been a lot of learning through the course of the last decade. One of the things that I'd really like to see shifting is how we do research. So we do a lot of research work and kind of shifting from a more, from research that's focused on sort of extracting evidence or data to kind of collaborating with the group that we're researching. So kind of more participatory in its approach. I think that's one of the big shifts that I'm looking to make or have started already in process. The second is also how we work with organizations. So in the past, it's been very project-based. So we sort of do a project and we move on, which, you know, is traditional sort of consulting lingo. And I think we want to move from that model to something that's more facilitating the organization through the work that we're doing, ensuring that there's, that the work goes on. So there's some sort of sustainability of how it's taken up and we can support the organization in that process. So the changes in some ways, both in terms of how we work with organizations and how we research, are quite similar. Yeah.
Yeah, that's lovely. And, you know, that idea of moving towards participatory research really speaks to me. Because it feels like it's moving away from kind of from that top-down feeling of the consultants coming in. We're very bright. We've been to a lot of universities and we're going to help you, the community or the organization. It feels like to me the opposite of top-down. It feels like that you're situated within the organization and you're responding to their needs. As we said in the quote, their context, their impact. Could you talk a little bit more about that and what that means?
Absolutely. I think, you know, you said it absolutely right. It's moving away from that sort of top-down approach. It's also thinking about when you're doing research, sort of more traditionally, the power lies with the researcher. So kind of you collect the information and then you are privy to what that information is telling you and how you analyze it. And that kind of gives you that power of the information, which if you think about it, isn't really fair, right? You're collecting information from someone and that, you know, that analysis should be owned by them. And what happens with that data or information should return to them. And so, so that's exactly the goal, is to shift away from that top down. As a researcher, I have, you know, I keep all the information. I have the power with me to say the goal is really to use that to benefit everyone. And so conceptually, that's the idea. How you make the shift is a little bit more complex, I feel.
Yeah, it really speaks to resisting the idea of the researcher as coming from the ivory tower and being much more situated within the organization or the community. Could you talk about maybe an inciting incident or an experience you had with a community where it was kind of a light bulb moment and you realized that this had to change? You know, what was the shift for you?
I think there's been a few kind of pieces that happened back to back, but I think one of the big ones is, you know, we did this project where we collected a whole lot of data, and it was on schools in a community. And the idea is that normally that data would come back, it would be collated, put into a report, and then shared with, say, the nonprofit or the funder who were working on the project. And I think the sort of big light bulb moment was we had this one partner who gave us the opportunity to take that data back. So we actually went back into schools and presented our findings to the stakeholders we worked with. That was everyone, right? So not only parents and teachers and principals, but actually the children themselves. And I think what was really inspiring was when you present the data of, okay, these are some of the problems that we find or that we found in the research. It wasn't, you know, the response wasn't defensive or that's not true, but sort of a brainstorm that emerged on, okay, how can we work on that problem, right? What are some solutions we can find? And I think that was the idea, right? Is that how do you get to those solutions is by co-owning the information. And I think that's really what clicked for me is what are you going to do to take it forward, right? It can't be research for research's sake.
And Aparna, did that come partially out of your thesis that you wrote for the degree that we both did in Change Leadership run out of HEC Paris and Oxford Said? Was there a relationship in your thesis to that experience that you've had?
Yes, absolutely. So just kind of an anecdote on writing the thesis, because we were, you know, sort of this support group for getting through that. I think one piece was when I first started writing the thesis, I did want to experiment with more participatory methods. I wasn't able to completely take that forward, but that was something I explored with the professors, with my advisor, in terms of how would I do that? What would that look like? And they said, I think it was Matisse, he said something quite interesting to me, which was, one is, of course, you want to be more participatory, but also you can think about what that means in different ways. It doesn't have to look just one way. So there are many ways to do that as well. So even an interview, just in the opportunity and the space you provide, can be more participatory in itself, right? And so that was one learning from the thesis. The second, which was really interesting, is one of the organizations that I interviewed for my thesis, and my thesis was on how organizations scale their work. And they were looking at community change in villages, so in rural India. And so looking at how do you really make shifts in mindset and how villages function and how communities operate. And they did some experiments with focusing on individual leaders. So if you equip the leader, can you see significant change over time? And, you know, they're speaking over 5, 10, 15 years. And what they found is that failed completely. So the individual leader wasn't able to create the kind of change that that they would have liked to have seen or that they were working towards. And when they shifted their model to instead focus on a group, So, starting off in a village, could we work with a group from the community who come together? And that was much more successful. And they found that that was actually the answer in terms of investing not in an individual leader, but in creating a group that comes together to collaborate to bring about change.
It's so interesting that you're saying that. And what's coming up for me as you speak is a parallel with corporate, because in corporate communications, there's been this sort of broadcast one-to-all messages from the CEO inbox,
You're right.
and it doesn't work.
Right.
It just doesn't land. And we studied change leadership, you and I, for 18 months. What works in a change process is if you involve people, if you get their buy-in, if you co-create, if they help you build the story and become ambassadors, but they're just plonking a change on people top down. You can do it, you can push it through, but there's no guarantee it'll work.
And I think it's also just, I mean, exactly how you say, right? You need to involve people. But realistically, that takes energy and effort and planning and time. And so the people leading the change have to be really invested in seeing that through, I think. Else, it's easy to revert back to the, okay, here's the change we're making, rather than kind of integrating and like meaningfully involving, not just, like not just the token of involving people.
Yeah, it has to be meaningful for sure. And Aparna, this idea of participatory research, are you like a complete forerunner, or are you seeing pockets of it popping up elsewhere?
Yeah, it's really interesting because when I decided that this is what I wanted to do, I had to, really go back to the drawing board and learn. And, for me, it evolved quite naturally in like, okay, this is how we want to work, but where can I kind of grow my practice and learn? And so I've seen it as a really strong emerging field in the UK, actually. And it's sort of something that's being taught at universities and being integrated into coursework. So I think there's like a there's an emergence of it in the academic world, but it's slow in practice, which is challenging because if you're being taught it, are you getting to actually practice it in the field? And so I think there is a bit of a gap. So there's a strong emergence of it in academia and in how young people are learning, but I'm not seeing that much of it on the ground in practice. And I think, for logistical reasons of it's time consuming, it's expensive, it requires you to really truly invest in the research, which you now notice that a lot of people are not. They're doing it because it's something that they have to do or because of the funding or, things like that. So quite interesting to see kind of the mix of the two worlds.
Yeah, two things are coming up for me. The one is, it's interesting that this shift is coming in the UK, because I really see participatory research as anti-colonialist. And I think that it's that the fact that the shift is coming out of the UK just seems like an antidote to the country's history. But the other question that comes up for me as you're talking is, do you have to educate your clients, the communities that you work with? Like, this is how we're going to work. I'm not diving in, doing the research, and giving you a lovely document at the end or a report.
I'm going to answer both. So I think the first was just the observation. I think you're absolutely right. I would say that while participatory research might not be embedded in our parts of the world, in India and South Africa, they are very much a part of how communities function. So, the technical terms of the research may not be there, but I think, the form and the understanding really emerges from the global south, right? In terms of how people live and how people function. And so, the example that I give of community groups versus the individual leader, I think that also speaks to the community in some way, right? And so the natural state and being of the community that it's emerging from. So that's kind of the first thought. The second, yes, absolutely. And that's actually been a really big challenge of I have decided that I really want to work in this way, but what does that mean for clients and what does that mean for taking on projects, right? So discussing it, educating my partners, but also gaining acceptance for it, right? So people are so used to seeing, you know, a graph or a number or a percentage, and that's really what they think of as data often, right? Like, okay, but you haven't given me the count. Or and so to make that shift and say, but what value is that bringing to you, right? Like, what are you going to do with that number? And it definitely is having that conversation of, great, you have this piece of information. What do you really want to do with it, right? So what does it mean? How will you use it? How will it impact where you're working? And yeah, so sometimes the conversation goes really well. Sometimes it's just not what people are looking for. And it will take longer to make that push and that shift. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I'm really glad that you pointed out that the way communities operate in the Global South have already been working this way for decades, if not centuries. And I think it's super interesting to see academia, mostly in the North, being influenced by communities and the way that they work in the South, which is a shift that probably is a long time coming.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it is. Yeah. So Aparna, you've led teams both in your own business, but you also lead consulting initiatives with other partners, and you also work deeply in communities. How would you describe your leadership style?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, so I'm really invested in the shared leadership model and thinking about how you can create sort of multiple layers and levels of leaders when I lead. In fact, my first experience leading a team, I was quite young. It was maybe I was in my mid-20s, and it happened by chance where I was suddenly left with a team of 120 people and no experience. And I was just there and had to lead the team. And so I think that was my biggest learning point of understanding when you're thrown into it, how do you operate as a leader versus now later on when you've had time to reflect on it, how you work as a leader. And in that experience, I definitely learned a lot about my natural style of leadership is focusing on creating multiple leaders, focusing on either geography or in terms of specialization and kind of having that network of leaders work together to manage a situation and kind of looking to their expertise to support me through it. I'm not sure I answered your question sufficiently, but yeah, I thought it was an interesting example to draw on to share with you.
And has it evolved over the years, or do you feel like it was very much in emerged naturally from that first experience?
I think it's a bit of both. So definitely emerged naturally from the first experience. But I also think that my biggest learning has been that the situation demands you to be a different type of leader. So when I was running that team, 120 people across 12 states, fairly hierarchical because it had to be in terms of how it was structured and situated, to when I became a founder and I had a founding team of 5 people, it requires you to be a totally different type of leader. So I think one is, of course, your own natural leadership style, but the second is what is required and demanded out of you and being able to adapt to that. So I think for me, that's the biggest learning, is shifting my leadership style to fit the situation. So in a founding team, you're looking at, you know, how do you run a startup? How do you build vision? How do you have that sort of excitement, keep openness for, you know, different avenues and be that sort of very flexible leader? Versus in the first, you know, the very large team, the focus is on, okay, we really have to deliver things, and that requires sort of precision and focus on, you know, getting things right, which is just a very different way of operating.
Yeah, I love those thoughts about leadership, and that hasn't really come up in any of other of my interviews, which is it's partially about you and your natural, what comes up naturally for you as a leader and how you like to be as a human, but also flexing with the situation that you're in. And you can impact on the situation, but the situation also impacts on you.
Right.
And that's very helpful, I think, thinking about leadership.
I think if you stick with your leadership style and enter into a context which it doesn't lend itself to, it can make things very difficult for both you and the team. So I think you're right in that it's useful, but also you will have to adapt. So either you only choose situations that lend themselves to your leadership style, or you find a way to kind of shift and mold to the situation.
I've always felt that my first leadership experience in comparison to you came quite late. And I think I was quite awkward around it. I think that I felt my way into it over time. But at first I was sort of casting around for other examples. While at the same time I had an inner intrinsic knowing. And I think my sort of internal battle was between the examples I saw, which weren't great, right, and the way that I wanted to lead. And I sort of went through a few years of battling that out, and eventually Charlotte's version one, which was a great relief probably for everybody around me. So Aparna, what does diversity mean for you, both as an individual and as a leader? So, you know, a lot of my interviewees have been from the global north, where diversity is much more acute. But, you know, you live and work in India, and I originally come from South Africa, where it's less about diversity, but more about transformation, correct?
Yeah. That's a really good question, a really big question. I have maybe two separate thoughts, and I'll share both. And they're both sort of experiences that I had that I think were quite interesting. I think the first was I studied in the US, so I spent a long time, so maybe 8 years studying, living and working in the US before I moved back to India, where I've been for a really long time. And I think it was very interesting for me because the conversation of diversity is something that's very intentional in the US, which was new for me. It was an experience I hadn't had when I was younger. We're talking, you know, 25 years ago in India. But it was also very challenging for me because it was diversity that was being, or like identity that was being forced upon me. So in the US, I was constantly told, you know, what is your experience as a person of color? And I couldn't understand it because that's not where I came from, right? I came from a society where maybe diversity was different identities of mine. And I found that really challenging, actually, because I kept being told, you must be having this experience, or this must be, you know, can you talk about that? And I kept thinking, but I don't relate to that. I don't understand that. You're sort of forcing that identity on me. So that was my first experience where it was reflection circles or spaces where I was, you know, asked questions like this, where I just couldn't relate to it, right? I didn't understand. I didn't have the same experience that maybe someone very similar to me growing up in the US might have had. So that was the first experience, which I think, you know, made me think a lot about, you know, what does diversity really mean? Where does your identity come from? How do you, you know, how are you thinking about it? And are you thinking about it because you want to think about it, because you're being forced to, those sort of pieces? So that's the first. And the second piece was when I moved back to India and I took on this role where I was leading the team. And it was a very, very large team. And we were operating across 12 states of India. And some of the states that we worked in were states where issues of gender, issues of hierarchy remain big challenges. And here I was at, you know, 27, leading a team as a woman. And it's the first time that I was confronted with what does that look like, right? What does pushback look like? How do I cope? How do I deal with this? And I had sort of very interesting experiences where I had then gone on to hire female leaders to work within those states, and they were facing major challenges. So, you know, from the kind of state leader in the organization, etc., there was leaving them out of meetings, there was behavior that I was absolutely shocked by, you know, whether it's yelling or just experiences that were a first for me. And my biggest challenge was not just for me as a leader, but now how do I support my leaders through this? Which for me was much, much more concerning and much more something that I really had to solve for. I was really young, and so my only thought was, I have to solve for this. So when I look back, I think I also reflect on this as one of my biggest failures, because I couldn't solve for it, because I don't think anybody can solve for it immediately. But also my biggest learning on what does it mean to be a female leader in a location or a context where it hasn't really happened before. Sorry, I think I started rambling on there.
No, it was both fascinating answers. And to the first one, I love the self-awareness of, I love the process of understanding that what you went through, having just been a person, suddenly in America you were a person with an identity, then also the self-awareness of, wow, this is really tough for those female leaders. And I wondered, is that where your sort of instinct or your interest to coach has come from? Because you were suddenly forced into a coaching situation without necessarily the coaching skills or the training.
I think you're making me reflect now. Absolutely. And I think that role actually was the first time that I learned so much about myself. And I think the first thing I learned was that I don't have much interest in managing a large team through operations, because that's not where my passion or strength lies. But on the other side, developing emerging leaders was sort of the biggest joy that I got from that role. So definitely started there, and I felt that sense of, can I support someone through a process? Can I be there to see their journey and allow them to emerge from it? So yes, definitely that was where the sort of interest in coaching emerged. I don't think I had the vocabulary for it. I didn't know it was coaching until much later when we were, in our master's program together, and I understood that, oh, this is something I can actually do. Like, it's got a name and it's got tools and it's got... but it was more sort of a natural emergence of how do I support people through their leadership journey. Yeah.
And where are you now with your coaching?
Yes, it's been an interesting process. I started quite accidentally. So I was working on strategy with a nonprofit, and the leader, she was a female CEO, and she just came to me one day and said, can you do some one-on-one with me? Because I am struggling with, the founder navigating the sort of growing the organization, working with the team. And at that time, I hadn't started coaching. I didn't have all the tools or vocabulary, but I knew her well enough that I said, okay, let's give it a go. And we did, we did 10 sessions together. And very interestingly, at the end of the 10 sessions, she decided to shut down the organization.
Wow.
Which was great, because it was the right thing for her. But it was also a great learning for me in terms of allowing the coaching process to go where it needs to go. And so that's sort of how I began, the official coaching journey. And since then, it's been quite slow. So I'm trying to kind of just have a few coaches at a time, really move through the process, allow myself to learn and also be really present. So at any given time, I have two or three coaches at the moment, quite organically through my, through my consulting and other work, folks who feel like it would be useful for them. So that's where it's at in terms of how much it grows from here. I really like the idea of keeping it quite small, so that my ability to be present and to really kind of support them through the journey stays, because I'm not sure how I would be able to do that if it was much larger, at the moment, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand that need to be present for people and not think, Which of my coaches is it? Am I talking to right now?
Right.
Aparna, do you think about your own reputation at all? And if so, how?
It's a good question. Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, when I started the company, I was really young, and it was more of an emergence of thought of, okay, this is something that's needed. It's a way for me to make my mark in the world. And I never really thought about reputation, you know, specifically thought about reputation. What is interesting is that I named my company after me. So it has the same, you know, it's Aparna Bazin Consulting. So it is, you know, I am a representative of the company. And yet I never really focused on my own reputation. And I think that's actually been one of the learnings that I've had as I reflected on, you know, the one decade of work. So what's interesting is that we have built as an organization a very strong reputation through the work that we did. And I always let the work speak for the company. So, you know, ensuring that when we sign a project, the quality that we deliver is really high, even if it comes at the cost of, you know, us having to do extra work or have to go above and beyond to make sure that what we're delivering is of a certain quality. So I would say to some extent, the organization has built a reputation for the quality of work. But I'm now learning as I've hit the 10-year mark that it's not just about the organization, but it's definitely about me and thinking about my reputation. So I'm in the very early starting phase of, you know, thinking about that and in starting to invest time and energy in building that as we go forward.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I've seen. And it's, I think it's quite typical of founders that the reputation of the business and the founder are completely enmeshed because it's one story, right?
Yeah.
But as businesses grow or shift like yours,
yeah,
the two start to slightly untwine, become unenmeshed,
yeah,
still equally valid, but very slightly different. So are there elements of your reputation that you're going to be putting into practice, or is it still too early to say?
No, I think it's really valid. And I think that's actually one of my reflections from the 10 years is that I have not invested enough time and energy in reputation. And maybe it is something that I should have. So I think definitely thinking a lot more about what do I bring to the sector in terms of thought leadership. What do I bring, you know, beyond the projects that I'm doing? What is it that I'm bringing to the world? What value can I create? Which I think is a big part of my reputation. So early days, I think I have a lot to learn and a lot to think about. But definitely starting point is here. Yeah.
Lovely. Well, I wish you all the best with all of that. Now, Aparna, as you know, my big mission is... we have an old archetype of leadership in our brains. That's what your female team leaders came up against in that first team that you were working in and leading. We have this old archetype of what leadership is, what should be. It's kind of, it's almost our neuroscience.
Yeah.
And we need to change that because it currently is not working very well for us globally.
Absolutely.
So what do you think we can do collectively and individually to shift that archetype and start to accept a new one?
Do you mean as individuals or as a collective?
Both.
Yeah. I think there's sort of two or three things that I imagine. I think the first is just visibility. So I think the more we're able to see different leaders, the more we're able to kind of learn from experience, and the more visible they are, I think that makes a huge difference. And I think that means... at least for me, that means in any domain, right? So whether that's as early as when you're in school, right? What does leadership when you're in school look like? Because it's not just about when I enter the work world, right? I'm forming my ideas of the world so early, and I'm seeing that all around me in community, in school, in, you know, all of those experiences. So that's the first that I imagine is, you know, how visible different forms and identities of leaders from that early age that I experience. The second is something that I mentioned before that I think there's so much of that happening. If you look back at ancient society, you look at communities, you look at the way people operate. And I think it's something that is really big in the space that I work in, is how are we learning from indigenous sort of knowledge, and how are we learning from things that have been done for centuries that we've kind of put on the back burner and forgotten. And I think there's a great opportunity there to study, to understand, to learn from, things that are already happening in many places that are just either ignored or forgotten.
Yeah, I really love that. You know, reattach to the wisdom that's always been there, instead of trying to reinvent wisdom with top-down ivory tower, non-participative research, but to really center ourselves back into our communities and the wisdom that is there. Thank you so much, Aparna. So now I get to the three questions I always ask. Give us a book recommendation.
Okay, it's a little technical, but I really am enjoying it. There's a book called Post-Anthropocentric Social Work, and it's a book of essays, and I can send you the name as well. But I've been reading through the essays, and some of the ideas in there are absolutely incredible. And they also are really, really aligned to the conversation that we've had today of, what do our relationships look like? Who are we as leaders? It's really, I mean, it's a hard read, but it's really, really good and meaningful.
I'd absolutely love to read that, just as I'm also thinking about leadership and how it needs to shift. I think that would be really valuable. Thank you. And leaders who are emerging now, who come from diverse backgrounds, they may have diverse identities, they may be from underrepresented minorities, they have ambition to lead. What would be your three tips for them?
I think the first would be to be yourself, so to find a way to be authentic. And I think you talk a lot about this, but to really be yourself. I think the second would be that you're not alone. So even though it often feels like you are, and it often feels like I'm really alone here, that there is somewhere a network of support that you can draw on, whether that's in the place where you are, whether that's outside, but just to remember that you're not alone. And the third one, I think, is just you can do it, right? So like it is possible, and that you can do it.
That's lovely. So I'm just going to repeat those. Be yourself. Remember, you're not alone, and you can do it. Leadership is within you. And that was one of the things that came up a lot for me in my research for We Need New Leaders, especially interviewing emerging leaders in their 20s and 30s, was you don't need to wait for permission. You don't need to wait for someone to crack a door open. If leadership is your ambition, whether it's creating your own business or leadership in another way, it's absolutely possible for you to do it. It's not something that belongs to older generations, for sure. And Aparna, my last question. The world is tough sometimes. Sometimes there's a feeling of heaviness. What brings you joy?
I think it's really friends and family. It's the people in my life, definitely. Just time with them, connections. I think definitely that's what brings me the most joy.
Yeah, for sure. I can relate to that. Aparna Basin, thank you so much for joining me on Speech Bubbles.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.